Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church, and for those who are disillusioned. On today's podcast is a comedian who I first met just as he embarked on his career. That was over 20 years ago. Embarked is a good word, as he's often to be seen live on cruise ships. But what is it like to be an entertainer on a floating resort? What is his Journey into the Wild project all about? How would you survive within the entertainment business, especially with your family suffering with rain in the UK, whilst you're enjoying the Caribbean sunshine? All that and more as I speak to today's guest, and that is Tony Vino. Tony, thank you so much for joining us today, sir.
Oh, it's great to be on. Thank you, Martin.
I'll send you the check later on. Loads to talk about, because as I say, we haven't really talked to each other for over 20 years. But before we do that, five sensible questions, or maybe not. Fingers on the buzzers, no conferring, please. Question number one, if you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask them questions, who would it be?
Oh, my goodness. Right. I've got one person. I love history. Good. And love reading sort of quirky moments in history. So I'm going to go for a guy called Jan Matthys, right? And he was a
Johnny
leader.
Matthys's son.
Yeah, yes, that's exactly the one, right? Yeah. It might be probably his great-great-great-great-great-granddad, because this guy was he was around in the 1500s, right? And it's an interesting story, but yeah. I'll do it very quickly. There was a thing called the Munster Rebellion, right?
Yes.
Which was, have you heard about this, where it was an Anabaptist rebellion, like violent Anabaptist rebellion, where they took over the city of Munster, after there was a thing called the Peasants' Revolt and all this, or the German Peasants' War in the sort of 1520s. Anyway, so he basically declared, look, they got enough Anabaptists in power, and there's a guy called Bernard Rothman who was on the council, and eventually they expelled the Prince Bishop, because it was a bishopric. It was run by the Prince Bishop, and they basically declared it like the new Zion. And it's a fascinating moment in history, because obviously Anabaptism was a sort of protesting movement, which is largely known as a sort of peace movement, right? But they actually armed up but this guy, Jan Matthys, was the founder, and he created a sort of citizens' assembly and basically said, look, in terms of, let's create the new Zion, Christ will come again. But before then, let's all do an early church thing where we have all our possessions in common, and no one should have any more money than anyone else. So they tried to create this
commune,
this kind of commune of Eden, you know. And then anyway, I think he was really earnest, right? Because some people go, was he, you know, are they mad, bad, sad, or a saint or whatever? But this guy was probably slightly mad and slightly saintly, because he really did believe that Christ was about to come back. And then the Prince Bishop sort of assembled all his armies around Munster, and they're about to attack. And this guy, Jan Matthys, said, and so the citizens all armed up to repel them. But he went, don't worry about that. And he sort of believed himself to be a kind of, I don't know what you'd call, almost like a prophet. I think he sort of likened himself to, I can't even remember which prophet it was, but anyway,
one of them.
And he said, it's better if we, you know, God will be my protection. We'll protect the city. So he just said, I'm going to go out against them with 12 people. So he took 12 people with him, right, up against thousands, you know, like, and he just was on the back of a sort of donkey. And he said, don't you worry, the angels will protect me. And so the whole city of Munster were like, our prophet, this is incredible. Let's watch God, you know, fight for us and all this kind of stuff. And then they were like watching, going, oh my God, this is going to be amazing. And then basically he just sort of, a few of the soldiers ran into him and then chopped his head off, right? And so killed him. It was quite, and they basically sort of put his head on a pike and then chopped off his genitals and stapled them to the doors of the city. And then after that, it gets totally crazy. There was a guy called Jan van Leyden, who was his successor, who was totally mad and probably quite a narcissist, young guy in his 20s. Because this guy Mathis was a baker by trade. Anyway, so he's gone. So this guy Mathis said, right, okay, we're creating a new city state, and we've just not been faithful enough to all, you know, to the leadership. And so now I'm the leader. And he created like almost like a sort of Palace of Versailles situation, but the whole city was starving. But he had a sort of Agincourt kind of, you know, like he was really living really sumptuously. And then because there was three times as many women, he then introduced polygamy into, and he had 16 or 18 wives himself. And anyway, it all went on. So it all went kind of crazy. And it did get, you know, basically they got taken over. They actually did repel all the legions quite a few times, but eventually they got taken over. And to this day, outside the cathedral in Munster, there's three cages, and this is like from about 500 years ago, and that's where they put this guy Jan van Leyden, Matthias's successor, and the other leaders, and they, you know, that's where they tortured him and killed him. But it was just a fascinating moment, like a crazy moment in religious history, because you just go, like, the Anabaptists tooled up, and it's been a peace movement ever since. There was one offshoot called the Battenbergers that also thought you need to have a sort of a violent force of Anabaptism, but the rest of them were like, it's been an incredible movement of you know, dissenting opposition. But anyway, it's just one of those crazy moments. But I'd love to just get Jan Mathis along for dinner and just go, so, because, like, what happened? Because he, like, totally, like, he was just, it's just one of those funny moments where he's like, don't worry. And the whole city, you imagine thousands of people looking over the wall, going, this is the moment. Our leader, he's going to take down all the hordes of the enemy, you know, and just, he just got his head chopped off.
He must probably turned around and said, it's only a mere flesh wound or something. Quoting another film.
Yes, like it.
Well, congratulations. That goes down, I think, as the longest answer we've had for the first question. So well done.
Strap it. This can go from a podcast to a hostage situation. When you get me on history, I love it, mate.
Well, and me too, especially as until recently, I'd never heard of the Anabaptists. Excuse my ignorance. So I then had to read up a bit about it. And there's that famous story of the chap going across the ice because he's been chased.
Yes, running across the ice. And then he went back, didn't he, to help his pursuer.
Yeah, pursue him and pull him out. Mm-hmm. Only for like a few months later, that pursuer had to stand up in court to say, yes, it was him what done it, Gov. But it didn't matter because he was still sentenced to death or something. Wasn't it? Have I got the right story? He being the person that pulled the bloke out of... Anyway, thank you. Great. Question two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable?
Love that. Okay, right. So many, but I'm going to have to choose. Again, I like to come to things, like, I do try and look at the funny moments.
Yes.
And for me, one of the funniest moments in Scripture is, so you know the book of Esther.
Okay, yes,
the book of Esther,
Mordecai,
prince of, you know, the king of Persia, is not happy with his queen Vashti because she won't dance. I mean, I prefer it when my wife doesn't dance at public occasions, but he was like, yeah, I'm so annoyed you dance. I'm going to get a new wife. He's got a new wife. There's a beauty contest. Esther becomes the wife of the king. And then this guy, Haman, who's was the Agagite, I think he was called. Anyways,
but he's the one you boo in a pantomime.
He's the pantomime villain, and he's my favourite character. He's the dun dun dun. Here comes Haman. Boo! He's like, you know, you kind of your hook character.
Yes,
and so it was the idea that how pride goes before a fall. So, so the king said, you know, exalted him and said, right, everyone's got to bow down to him. But Mordecai, as a faithful Jew, and who was also had adopted Esther, and an all-round top wise guy, decided, you know, didn't bow down to Haman. So Haman's like, I'm going to kill him. And then conspired to get him killed. And then there's this moment. So there's two moments that are sort of like, it's slightly schadenfreudery in its humor, but there's a moment where the king is all kind of you know, worrying about his life, and then he goes through the annals of history and then finds out that he, you know, a plot to have himself assassinated had been foiled, and it was Mordecai that had done it. And so he goes to Haman, hey, if someone had done an amazing thing for the king, what would you do? And Haman thinks it's going to be him. So the man's like, so he goes, what you want to do? Put him on the best horse, get someone to stand before him in a procession through the city to go, isn't this guy amazing? He's top. And the king's like, that's such a good idea. Now, you go do that to Mordecai. And it's just a beautifully kind of wonderful moment where it inflames Haman's, you know, anger and passion. But it's quite funny as well, because it turned out it's one of those comic moments. And then he creates some gallows, because he's like, I'm really angry with this guy, boy, I'm gonna get you. And then he creates some gallows, and then in the end, because he there's a moment where the king thinks he's coming on to his wife, he then gets hung on his own gallows, which is kind of, it's sort of funny, but not funny, but it's the idea, as an archetype, it's quite funny in that you know, you basically get hung by your own, but you know, if you create your own structures of hatred.
Hoisted by your own petard is the expression, isn't it?
Well, like, so I don't, if a gallows was a petard, then exactly. He was Captain Petard in this situation. There you go.
Very good. Question three. If you could be Prime Minister for the day and could change any law or impose new law, Tony, what would it be?
Well, the thing is, you think being Prime Minister for a day is a long time in the current political climate. Because, like, you go, you know, when Truss and Kwarteng got in place, I think the main thing is, whenever you start a new job, take it easy for the first day, right? Just, you know, don't try and change everything, you know.
Exactly.
Just get to know the coffee machine, get to know, you know, learn your passwords, you know, to log on, that kind of, but, you know, they were like, I've got a great idea. What I'm going to do is just change the entire track structure of the economy. Surely nothing bad will happen. And then bang, you know, the whole system melts down. And you can just imagine Kwasi coming home that day and his wife going, so how was your first day at work, love? Well, could have been better. So I think I wouldn't want to do too much.
That's called wisdom, I think.
Thanks very much. Yeah. So I think I just want to do one thing that would make a small difference. And
yes,
I would like to I'd do some kind of, you know, I'd set up a committee on saving the bees, and I'd do some kind of law where we'd introduce grants for people keeping their own bees. Because I think, you know, we need bees to pollinate and to eat.
Yes.
And for the end of the world not to happen.
Excellent. Okay. Maybe we get rewarded by, I don't know, a jar of honey or something like that for free.
Exactly, yeah. Sweet.
Yeah, that'd be great, wouldn't it? Thank you. Question four. Outside of family events, what has been your most enjoyable day out?
Oh, most enjoyable day out. Okay. I've had a good few, but I would say last year it was sunny and I went out with a lot of friends locally. We went climbing in a place called Wind Gatherer in the Peak District, and it was just so beautiful and sunny. And one of the things about, I do a bit of rock climbing. I do it indoors, but when the weather's good, sometimes I go outdoors with some friends to do it. And I remember thinking, it's play. And the beautiful thing about play, it's pointless, but it also means everything. You know, you put two jumpers down for goalposts and it becomes, you know, you're in Wembley. And there's a bit of rock, you know, and you scramble up it. The rock will still be there and it's entirely not bothered whether you go up it or not, but it was everything. And we were all cheering each other on and go on, you could do that. Yeah. And there was such a sense of fraternity, camaraderie. It was beautiful. So that was one of my favorite moments, certainly of the last couple of years.
Excellent. Question five. What has been your most embarrassing moment to date?
Crikey. Right, okay. So good question. Oh, I'll tell you what, there was one about 12 years ago. I was doing a show in Hull. at the KC Stadium in Hull. Oh. It was a charity boxing match, and they had about 600 people. And the organizer basically went, let's have a comedian before the fight start, right? So let's bring him onto the, you know, the boxing
canvas.
Ring.
Yeah.
Yeah, onto the canvas. How bad could this be? And I mean, it was bad, Martin. It was really bad. 600 people eating a meal. They're all there for boxing. They're all, you know, very noisy. They're all eating. They're all, and then I'm trying to do comedy from this stage, and it just was totally inappropriate. Like, it just didn't work. And then the microphone kept cutting out. And
oh, so you became Norman Thingy Collier.
Yeah, Norman Collier. Hip, hip, rip. So I had all that going on. And the guy from the PA desk ran to the side of the ring, said, pass us the microphone, passed it to him, and he put a new battery in, give me that back. And it still didn't work properly. And then eventually I did a few more minutes. And then another guy came, and he was in a suit. He looked quite official. And he came to the side of the ring and said, mate, come here, pass us the microphone. I passed it to him, and just in front of everybody, just grabbed it and just went, you're rubbish. And he's just like, and then he passed it back to me, like as if to say. So I was like, oh, thanks very much.
That was a sucker punch, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was his. That was his, like, yeah, bang, I was over, I was out.
Yeah.
So it was like, you know, I just wish my agent was there. I think he would have thrown a towel in at that point. But honestly. So it was just one of those moments where it got me thinking about, Matt, you know, I remember it must have been about 10 years ago, because my little boy was about one, he's 12 now, so it must be about 11 years ago. And he was one the next day. And I remember playing with him the next day, and he had no awareness of what I'd got, the trauma I'd been through the night before. I remember just playing with him, playing peekaboo, and I was absolutely smashing it, you know, peekaboo. And he was like, you're the funniest guy in the world, yeah. And and I just thought, oh, do you know what? It has no hold of me, this situation. Yeah. It was actually a funny situation. And I just let it go. But it was also, you know, it did cut deep as well.
Yeah, I can believe that. Well, thank you for sharing that. I mean, that leads then into, from those five questions, that was what happened 12 years ago. But what made you want to go into comedy in the first place, Tony?
As you know, as a man that 20 plus years ago worked alongside me in Crossrhythms and UCB. Then basically, I think it's evident to all that I'm fairly unemployable in most spheres. So this guy's going to have to plough his own furrow as something self-employed. But it was, you know, I think I've always loved entertaining. I've always loved making people laugh. Like, I remember at school, you know, I'm 44 now. So let's say 30 years ago, it was, you know, I used to watch Vic Rees' Big Night Out.
Yeah.
I used to do the sketches the next day, and they were like, they used to call me Trev, right? Because my second name is Vino, but it's actually Trevino. And they used to go, and I used to go, you know, whatever my mate was, you know, Gaz, I've fallen, and I'd fall over, and I'd redo the sketches. I just love making people laugh. And then I loved acting, and I got into drama, and I did theatre studies at college, and all that. And so I just loved holding court. But interestingly, I was also absolutely, completely frightened of public speaking as well.
Oh, really?
I used to tremble. I remember I did a law degree. And I had to do a presentation in front of the whole lecture theatre. I remember my legs shaking, my mouth going dry, and I hated it. But that, there's different people. You've got phobic and controphobic. Some people deal with fear by running away from it, and some people are controphobic. I think I am, where you sort of almost go more towards it. So I've based my entire career, earning, lifestyle, and livelihood, and that of my family as well, on doing something that I'm petrified of, you know, public speaking. So, so I've sort of painted myself into a corner.
Yeah.
And when I remember doing my first comedy night back in 2005, and just that moment where something lands, you make someone laugh, and you there's the delicious kind of vulnerability of saying something, trying what you might think is funny when you're speaking out in a bedroom, writing on a piece of paper, and then it getting a laugh, and the alchemy of that, how you turn from lead to gold, was so intoxicating, so beautiful that, you know, now, I don't know. I mean, I'm what, 17 years on doing stand-up. Now I'm just like, crikey, I still can't believe people are paying me for this.
Yeah.
So like somehow, you just find that something you love, as the old saying, isn't it? Find something you love, and then you'll never work a day in your life as long as you really enjoy what you're doing. And so I love it, but I love the immediacy of it.
Yeah.
I think I'm a bit too, people that I'm sure it's massively fulfilling, writing a book and then eventually 3 years down the line, seeing it published and seeing it, if you're very successful, on Borders Bookshop and on the Times New Bestseller List, or, having a commission for a play and then eventually seeing it wherever, but that to me is such a long drawn out process. I much prefer, you have an idea, M6 southbound services near Kiel, and then that's so funny. Here's a joke about Ginster's pasties, and then you try it that night in Kiel, and so alas, I much love the immediacy of that medium.
Yeah, no, I hear that. It's also the fact that you've been given the greatest accolade by your son, albeit only one or two, saying you're the world's funniest dad.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting for my 22-year-old son to tell me that, because every time I say to him, look, I am the world's funniest dad. No, not. And then he names everybody else, all my mates. They're funnier than you, Dad. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it does wear off, doesn't it, though? That he's 12 now, so I'm possibly the most embarrassing dad in the world.
Oh, no, no, that's me. I'm very good at that. Very good indeed. But see, you got this flavour of doing it. But for those that are listening and want to think, well, actually, I'm quite funny. How can I get on the comedy ladder? So how did you go out doing it, sir?
It's a very good question, that. I mean, and I'm going to tell you, even though, how many comedians can one ladder hold? I don't know. But basically, because it's one of those things, isn't it, where people say you should try stand up.
Yeah.
Should try comedy. It's one of those things on your bucket list, which I think is wonderful, because it goes very core to people's fear, and where your greatest fear is, sometimes that's where you feel most alive. And it's Jerry Seinfeld does a good joke where he says, there was a survey where he said, people's greatest fear is public speaking more than death. So he said at a funeral, people would rather be in the casket than doing the eulogy. Very good joke, that.
That's it.
Okay.
Sorry.
So I'd say the people should go for it, but I still also find, but I mean, I think we should try many new things. It always slightly irks me that, people go, I'd love to give stand-up a go, and you go, well, I've dedicated my entire life to it, but I'm glad you could see. Be weird if you came up to a brain surgeon, you say, oh, I'd love to give brain surgery a go. You're like, I've studied for this for 15 years now, and you're going to give it a go, right? Just get a scalpel and pull a bit of your friend's, frontal lobe out. But if you, the basic best way to do stand-up is first do a course and then... And then there are many, 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 many new material nights and new act nights across the country. Every major city, London, Manchester, they have them all over. And you just Google, new material act, and then contact the promoter. Do a cut. Now you can, there's courses, mainly in the big cities like London, and there's one called Laughing Horse that do a comedy course. There's even a degree. At Salford University.
Really?
In comedy. Yeah, they actually do an undergraduate degree in comedy writing, comedy performance, and all the rest of it.
Oh, okay.
Jason Manford used to teach on it back in the day, interestingly. Tony Vino has done an online comedy course on a platform called Udemy.com. So what was that, Martin? Yeah, it's $10.99. Thanks for asking.
No, I was just about to ask. I've got a pen now. You're too quick. So perhaps at the end of the program, you could give it to me again so I could write it down.
Okay, I'll give you that. Udemy.com. So you can do a comedy course and then give it a go. But either way, I'd say the thing is, there's nothing more beautiful than having an idea, crafting it in a story, and then making people laugh. So even if not a comedy night, I would really encourage people to, because to just do public speaking. You know, when someone says, go on, get, you know, you're at a wedding or a birthday or, you know, ting, 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 let's have a speech, you know, it's your birthday or whatever, do a speech and put some thoughts together and just do it, because people do say, how do I get better? Particularly if I've not yet paid performer and I'm getting those invites. I just say, whenever there's a microphone or the possibility for an audience, hold court and do it, because that's essentially what comedy is. For that 20 minutes, half an hour, 45, however long, you are being given the privilege to speak and people to listen, and so it's incumbent upon you to make the most of that moment. But it's only practice that will get you to the point where you'll find your voice. So it was Les Dawson, famously, he was doing an after dinner event, and he was getting paid like about £10,000 for doing a 20-minute. And the chairman of the golf club or association or whatever said, "Oh, crikey." I said, "Tell you what, Les, I'd love to do a job where I got paid, you know, 10 grand for 20 minutes. And then Les was like, "Listen here, son, I'm not getting paid 10 grand for 20 minutes. I'm getting paid 10 grand for 42 years of hard graft in the clubs." And it makes sense, doesn't it? You know, he'd worked at it. You're getting paid for your experience and your craft.
Which is a bit like when you buy a car and it's like a brand new car, £40,000, a brand new car. Mm-hmm. Can't cost that much, but obviously people forget the R&D, research and development and everything else that goes into it. It's the same sort of thing.
Exactly. Maybe. Exactly. Yeah. Maybe. Getting paid for the everything that goes before that. And that's part of the reason why it seems so incongruous with stand-up, because part of the idea of comedy is meant to look like a stream of consciousness. It's meant to look like you're just making it up on the spot often, because it is, because it's the beauty and the deliciousness of the live experience. Someone's like, "Oh my goodness, I can't believe," you know, someone shouts something out and you come out with a great response and everyone's like, "That guy's a genius," but you might have used that response 30 times before, because at one point it did work and then you went, "I'm going to note that," and then suddenly you have 40 responses over however many years that all then make it look like you elevate your own capacity to be spontaneously brilliant.
Yes. Now, I remember it was Max Boyce, I think, he had a great one-liner put down from all the heckles. But it shows you just how it wouldn't work these days, because technology, especially in TVs, has gone so far forward. But back in my day, when you had like 525 lines or 65 lines, the picture would often be pretty bad. And the BBC or ITV would put a sign up saying, "We apologise for the interference on the screen." Do you remember that?
Yeah.
So anyway, this heckler started going. And he says, "I've seen you on TV," said Max Boyce in his Welsh accent. He says, it's called interference. But it wouldn't work now, would it, you see, because people wouldn't know what interference on TV was.
No, but there's quite a lot of, I suppose technology-based put-downs you could sort of say to an audience member, "I'm just going to put you on hold there. Your call is important to us." You know, stuff like that.
No, that is good.
Ones that would be where it's like, you know, you bring it up to this standard. But there are, interestingly, in the comedy world, there are a few what you call standard heckle responses.
Oh, are there? Okay.
Yeah, as in, nobody knows the genesis of them, but they're very, you know, they're good. So if someone's talking, but they're sort of, you know, you might, you know, people say to, you know, where did you learn to whisper? You know, in a helicopter, that kind of thing. Like, because it can really irk an audience. Or there's obviously some that are definitely not of a PG standard as well. But it's basically, it's if you've got enough of these, and the idea is, if you've been going long enough, you learn to recognize something in a situation that then you can make look spontaneous that you don't do it. So something I used to do, I don't do it anymore because the TV program, so it's things like TV programs change.
Yes.
So I remember this is probably from about 15 years ago when I first started, I'd look at an audience And then I'd see if there was a couple of like good looking people, like young men, young women, you know, smartly dressed up or whatever. And then a group of maybe older people or whatever, just a normal looking group. And I used to go, it's great to be here. Wow. Look at this, you know, and look at the different groups, you know, down here, we've got the cast of Hollyoaks. Amazing. Look over there. Oh, there's the cast of Shameless up there. And everyone's like, ah, you know, and so it'd get the audience.
Yes.
Kind of interacting and riled, but yeah, it also would, it was referencing TV programs.
But there must be a put down then. If someone has been really raucous, what would you say they would be the cast of which TV program, do you think?
Oh, interesting. Nowadays, if I was to update that, I haven't done it for about 15 years, but I might go the cast of, I don't know, what would be, that's the problem. I don't know. Shameless was This Is England, maybe.
I wouldn't be on your cruise ship, obviously, because I don't know these programs.
I think I've heard
of them, but I don't know them. I'll let you think on that. All right.
Oh, I suppose you could do. That's one that I've thought maybe doing nowadays. Is if the audience is talking, sometimes it's about getting the people to listen. So I might say, look, this. I need to let you know this isn't Gogglebox, right? You're not meant to just comment all as I'm going along, because Gogglebox is one where people watch the TV and then comment on it. So something like that. So there you go. But that TV programs is a good common denominator, because a lot of people have watched.
Yeah, I got you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Well, that's at the end then, isn't it? Almost. But I did mention earlier on that obviously yourself are a Christian, but you're going to go on cruise ships. So how did it get involved? How did you get involved by getting onto cruise ship? And tell us what it's like to be a comedian on board a cruise ship, please.
Well, interesting. I mean, so at the time of recording, I'm leaving a week on Friday. We're off to the Barbados. And then I'm taking a friend who's a vicar friend of mine, a guy called Mark Cowling, which is an actual legend from Manchester. He's coming with me as well, so you can take a guest with you, which is cool.
Oh, wow.
And we're going round to some
Barbados.
Oh yeah, I've got one leaving from Liverpool.
Is it going to Belfast every like 7 hours?
Yeah,
going
to Belfast. There you go. I'd probably say I do a cruise ship maybe once every month.
Wow.
For like four or five days or something like that. On average. And then, you know, obviously there's comedy clubs and you know, after dinner speaking, but mostly just doing comedy clubs really. But the cruise ships is a different setup. Now, one of the things that has I would say prepared me for it, right? Not just the having been a stand-up for years and built up enough material, because you've got to have at least an hour and a half of material that then, but with also big show enders, because you're doing the big theatres on the ship, which can now, like essentially you have the end of the pier shows, and those shows, because they don't exist anymore, they've gone off the end of the pier and actually got onto ships and then floated off into the middle of the water. So you have huge theatres, like 1,500, 2,000 capacity.
Wow.
Yeah, huge. And so, because these ships now hold, like the P&O ones that I'm doing week on after, they can hold about 4,000 passengers, 1,500, so it's about 5,000 people, including staff overall. There was one I did for at the time, it was Royal Caribbean, which was the Lure of the Seas. Mm-hmm. And that was 5,500 passengers, right?
Wow.
So you have a lot of people. And, and so if you do the big theatre, I sort of do stand up, but I make stuff that is relatable to the city. So I might, you know, make jokes about the buffet or where we've gone, where we've been, make it quite international as well, but also have big sort of musical pieces, you know, stuff that might be like sort of fill that space, because you might have a huge stage and it's just one person talking. But I think what, you know, the sort of 10 to 15 years that I've doing stand-up before I even began on the ships, and I probably began on the ships maybe back, I think 2017 was the first time I went on the ships, was, crafting it in the comedy clubs and pubs and theatres and churches and all the rest of it, but also being clean as an act, I think really made, put me ahead of the pack in that. If you can play clean, if you can do comedy without swearing, without needing to be crude or rude or whatever, then you can play anywhere. You can play the comedy clubs Friday night where everyone's drunk and heck, you can still do those events. You can even do, you know, shows for like, you know, the Forces or whatever. But you can also do, you know, after dinner speaking at golf clubs or awards ceremonies, or you know, you can do stuff on TV and radio that is, that is, that you need to be clean. And you can do the ships where you know, basically the, you've got to be clean. So I think that's one of the things that it was time, preparation, practice, and that got me on. And then and I just really found my stuff, you know, went over. But it's not just the stand-up. It's what I like to do. I mean, you've not seen my act, but it basically... I
will
also
be on that ferry.
I'll see you. Hull to Zeebrugge. Yeah, I'll see you there. But basically, yeah, I do big show pieces as well where I might get a load of people up and we'll recreate a musical, or I'll get some, you know, I'll put music on and make something. It's basically, it's hard to describe, but I always like to end with something really big and, but also I'm very good at interaction. So that's how it came together. And then I get, you know, I have an agent who then has my diary and then puts, you know, right, okay, we'll put this in. And she'll ask, you know, when are you available? And I update that. And then she'll say, right, you've had this offer to go from bloody blah to bloody blah. Do you want to go? And I'm like, okay. And it is a bit of a, you know, it is a bit of a balancing act because obviously it's financially it's beneficial to keep everything going. It's a really good experience, but being away from home is a right gutter. I mean, you know, crikey, I've got a really nice house with a lovely family and friends, and I'm always like, I just, and people go, oh, isn't it great? You get to go and, you know, be on a ship for a week. And I'm like, well, eat it. But it's also, I am technically on my own. Like, and you're all here as families and, you know, and having a great time and you know, friend groups of friends and all that. And I'm basically in my room ready to go on stage. I do two or three nights, various shows. And then the rest of the time, I'm sort of mincing around the ship, you know, like just everyone just, you know, I have a little chat with people and I'm fairly social, but you know, if the company offered me the money to stay at home, I would. I'd do that instead.
do it by internet.
This would be great. Exactly. I love this, what we've got here. The sound quality is brilliant. If you could do this and pipe it in, that'd be ace.
Be brilliant, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you've alluded to the fact you're on the boat for like 5 days. Or 6 days or whatever. You're a Christian as well. Is that a plus or a minus point, do you think, to you, when they find out you're a Christian and you're an entertainer? Discuss.
Good question, right. So I would... it's interesting. The best conversations I find is I have with other performers. Like, it's interesting. It's not just... You normally it's just one stand-up on the ship, but then you also have a magician and various musicians and stuff like that. And it's easy. It's like as a fraternity of artists, you know, you can go when you're out at sea in the middle of the sea for days on end, you can really go deep. And you know, I don't find that there's much opposition to me being a Christian. And, you know, someone that really is, I would say, utterly convinced and committed to the story, you know, the revelation scripture, who Christ, you know, I am full on, like, it's
I'd
say
DNA.
Really, it's in my DNA, you know, a piece of Blackpool rock cut me in half and, you know, it's there. But I think I'm a quite a positive person, so I think it actually. I don't think it's just personality. I think it is also metaphysic. You know, the Christian hope the gospel hope, and which, you know, obviously the genesis of that comes all the way through the story of Abraham, Isaac, Israel, the promise to the, you know, the covenant promise that has been you know, seeded through that, you know, through scripture. And it's a wonderfully hopeful message, you know, the fact that God, you know, the world isn't just random. It's created and it's beautiful, and God loves it, and there was intention behind it, and actually we are loved, and death isn't the end, but actually this is all part of a much bigger, amazing, wonderful story. There's forgiveness hard baked into creation, into our souls, and love is a reflection of the eternal nature. I mean, it's an incredible, hopeful, wondrous metaphysic. So I think it does help in that sense, in that, you know, I'd like to think people, and people do often, you know, say, you know, how come you're so jolly all the time? And I try not to be annoyingly jolly, like, you know, Ned Flanders-esque, right? But I think I genuinely do every day, you know, just plant my feet on the floor and just say, you know, thank you, God. This, you know, you've given me life this day, and it's just gratitude. I think such an important approach to life, because, you know, we, every breath, it says, in Him we live and we breathe and have our being. So to actually take a moment, actually go, that breath was a gift, and that exhalation is a gift. Oh my goodness! What more natural response do we have than just to collapse on our face and go, thank you, God?
Well, taking a bit step further then, having nailed your colours to the proverbial mast, thank you, comedy or comedians have been known to be manic depressives in real life. So I'm not saying that you are a manic depressive. I'm not saying that at all. But how do you cope when you've faced the adulation, you've come off, the red roses have been brought to you, they all bow down and say, that was the funniest thing I've ever heard.
You came to that show, yeah.
Not me, as a friend said. And you then go back to your room. How do you cope?
It's a really good question. There's a funny story in the, it's a joke only told amongst comedians, which is talking about the idea of like how we love the idea of adulation and within comedy. So two comedians meet up, and one of them said, oh, I haven't seen you in ages, you know, how's things been? This comedian's like, oh, absolutely fantastic, oh my goodness, I've been smashing it. And I did this show at the Hammersmith Apollo, and did you hear about it? It's a charity event, but it killed. No, did I? Yeah. And so the, you know, the producer of Live at the Apollo booked me to, so I'm on Live at the Apollo next week. Did you? No, I haven't heard. Oh, fantastic. But and it went so great. And then obviously I've been supporting Peter Kay on his new tour. I don't know if did you hear about it? And we did the, you know, a couple of first recordings of his new DVDs, that, and I've got, you know, a bit part in that. It's amazing. Did you hear about it? No. It was incredible, and they've been going so well. Honestly, because it's bit, I mean, you know, so obviously there was last Thursday when I was at the King's Head pub, and I tried out some new material, absolutely died on my butt. And the comedian goes, oh yeah, I heard about that one. So there's like, there is moments where it is, you know, it can be sort of schizophrenic lifestyle, mm-hmm. where you sort of come off stage and either, you know, you can create this almost like synthesized response from that. Like people can love you and they don't really know who you are, but you've made them feel good and you've given them a moment. And there is something sublime about that. And I'm not taking away from that. And there is a beauty in it and a relationship there, but also people can actually hate you. You know, you've taken up their time and how dare you offend me with your whatever. But again, it's not you that they hate. It's a projection of, you know, the character that you're portraying and all the rest of it, and who knows, they might have even had a bad day and you were triggering that. But I think that moment when you get into your room, and let's say, you know, maybe doing a cruise ship is quite an intense moment of that, because you've done there is over 1,000 people at each show, maybe 1,500 people, you know, and it can be so incredible. And then you go to this little cabin, and then you're on your own, and everyone's having a great time. The whole ship, and you're just, and it's kind of like a weird moment. But I think I've, for me, I'm held through. Like my prayer life is really important. So every morning, I tell you, I don't know if anyone wants to do this, but I would say having where there's not structure, to impose a structure really helps. So I always do a thing called the Northumbrian morning prayer. So go on every morning. It's if you type it into Google, Northumbrian morning prayer. It's the Northumbria community. They have a liturgy, and I do it every morning. There's a 3 pieces of scripture that refresh every morning, and it's like, you know, Christ is light, illumine and guide me. Christ is shield, overshadow me. Christ under me. Christ over me. Christ beside me, on the left and on my right. This day be within and without me, alone me, all powerful, etc. So I find that having a liturgy that's set every day is a really strong foundation. But also then having a prayer life that is free flowing was really beautiful. But I think I've you know with stand up, you know, I've learned to not hook my identity to my work. And I think that's not just as a performer. I think that's really important for everyone, particularly men. I think we go through, you know, our 20s and really there's this sort of incessant need to kind of establish yourself in the world and find fulfillment in what you do and actually have it create a meaning through your activity. But actually I think there's a healthy detachment from what you do, and again I think the Christian metaphysic is a really healthy one, because you know it says, you know, God loves you, whoever, for who you are, not what you do. There's nothing you can do to make God love you more or less. You know, there's nothing you can do to make God love you more, or nothing you can do to really make God hate you. You are loved by the virtue of your being an image bearer of the divine nature that God is in, you know, and he's breathed you into existence and knew you in your mother's womb. So there's something really just, great. So I think it's wonderful when it goes well, but not, I believe it's not on an egoic level. I'm like, oh, isn't it great? Because my ego's, it's more I want to do a good job because I want to give people a good time, and life is difficult. And I think part of the role of the jester is to actually remind people of the ridiculousness of what it is to be alive and the ridiculousness of this situation. And if it's out at sea in this huge theater and this floating metal container at this moment in history, which is absolutely bizarre, well, let's remind you of that, and let's rejoice in being together and being alive, being this moment. So I think for me that'd be the, I'd try not to take that as, aren't I great? I'd say, isn't life amazing? Isn't God great? Isn't it wonderful to be together? So that's how I navigate that. I'd say I'm you know, and again, I don't want to be, you know, tell you what, I'm probably the most humble person I've ever met, Martin. But no, I'd say that's not my problem.
No, no.
Is like the inflation of ego. It's probably more at the other end going, oh my God, I'm just grateful that I haven't been found out yet and sacked by, you know, that's more the kind of what they call it, the imposter syndrome. I'm like, oh my goodness, this is incredible. I'm being paid, you know, all this money and getting flown out to the Caribbean and I'm doing shows in front of people, but they don't really know that I'm just me. And if they really knew how, you know, I can get bored of my own company, let alone, crikey, they why would they want to listen to me for 45 minutes?
Well, I have to. Just saying. And, you know, if P&O want to fly me out so I can do my Off-Grid Christianity podcast live on the stage.
That'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
You do it on the stage.
In front of 1,500 people.
But zoom back to just some bloke in his bedroom. That'd be ace. That'd be wonderfully...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry, I can't hear you. Speak up. Turn the microphone on. Yeah, maybe not. But that leads on then to Journey into the Wild project. In the remaining 5-10 minutes that we've got, Journey into the Wild project, or your song, what's it all about?
Yeah, so Journey to Wales. I did back in, but I believe it was 2012, so 10 years ago, the Men's Rites of Passage. If you go into themailjourney.org, it's a website. It's this idea that in the West we've lost rituals and the ritual of initiation for going from a boy to a man, and so it's the idea of a sort of ritualized space of for men to go on a weekend and really think through, but also engage with on a visceral level through sort of very physical rituals of what it is to take on the responsibility of manhood and adulthood. So I did that, and that's part of a much bigger worldwide movement. But out of that, you're encouraged to, you know, be part of a men's circle, and I've been part of a men's circle ever since for the last 10 years or so. And I've always been fascinated by well-being, mental health, and how, you know, single sex meet. I think there's you know, place for therapy and wellness groups in both mixed and single sex settings. And I think there's something uniquely powerful about men coming together and being able to sort of let down some of the barriers of trying to impress each other and all that. And so I basically, with this friend Mark, who's coming away with me,
yeah,
come away with me out to the Caribbean next week.
Yeah,
he's a vicar friend of mine, and we set up the Journey into the Wild. And for the last 10 years, we've been taking men away to different locations, and, you know, basically, you know, what's called the Way of Counsel, where you do talking circles, where you get a stick, and the person with the stick speaks, and then you pass it on to the next person, and you listen attentively. You don't respond to what the other person said, but you speak from your heart. Wow. Speak authentically. So you have that, and there's something really powerful and healing in those circles. And then, you know, and the idea, we call it Journey to the Wild, because it's there is a sort of wildness. We go walking out in the hills and light fires, and, you know, cook over open fires, all that. There's a sort of
Why you're lighting the fires. Phew.
So there's a semi wildness to it, but I think it's the idea that you journey into the wildness of your own inner being. It takes time to come away from your normal life and go, what are some of the things that are coming up for you, and essentially, you know, we are gifted to this world, and God has gifted us with life, and part of the idea of self-discovery is understanding how can you be a gift to others and of service. So the idea of, so there's a bit of exploration of what, you know, part of your gifting and how you give that back in the rest of your life. So that happens. So Journey into the Wild .co.uk.
Thank you.
Gives the information for the next year's, there's several weekends. There could be two weekends next year.
Excuse me, Mr. Dean, I've got a pen now. Just say it again, please.
Journeyintothewild.co.uk.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, that has been brilliant. Tony, it's been great catching up with you,
Martin,
after the past 20 years or so. What people don't know is that the first time I ever met you, you came down as an extra as I was interviewing a young lady. And I think you just got a lift. And I put you on air on the spot, I said, tell us a joke. And you told me the joke, and I remember that joke ever since.
Oh, yeah.
And you've only just told me that it wasn't your joke. You didn't make it up.
It was an Eddie Izzard joke. Yeah. So that was on air, you said, so this is 25 years ago, probably, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You went, this is even before I was a stand-up. This is at the time, I was working for another radio broadcaster, GNB, based up in Doncaster. Can I tell it now then?
Well, only if you play.
It's an Eddie Izzard joke. You said, tell me a joke. And I did. Went out with the lads the other day, had some jars. Then I went out with some more lads and then had a few more jars. Then I thought, crap, let's keep the night going, had a couple more jars. And then I thought, that's enough jam for me. And that was on an old Eddie Izzard recording. before he did his DVDs and all that. Yeah. I remember listening to an Eddie Izzard recording. I used to just love listening to stand-ups and, you know, all the guys that Ben Elton and all these guys before they were famous as well.
Well,
hearing them in the comedy clubs.
If we can finish there, because I think people are just getting off the floor having rolled around in laughter on that joke. But that leads very nicely into if that's one of your heroes in the comedy world, Eddie Izzard, who to close the show with, by the way. And if you want to get hold of us, it's ogc@accessradio.biz. Biz is about B-I-Z. ogc@accessradio.biz. Love to hear from you. This has been a BCSC production. One more thing to say, and that is Tony Vino, who is, and bearing in mind, it has to be dead, the person has to be dead, and not in the Bible, who is your Christian hero?
I mean, it's many people's Christian hero. It's got to be Francis of Assisi.
Hey. There's
some incredible moments in his life where he took the trauma and violence of his childhood. You know, he fought off in Perugia, was imprisoned he was a soldier and imprisoned, and then went off fighting again, and it was really impacted by that. But like, gave himself to poverty and a life of service to God, and you know, created the Order of the Brothers Minor. And I thought interesting how he would redeem this idea of violence and. There's a moment in 1219 where he went to one of the Crusades, and where there's been this really bloody battle in Dalmatia, which I believe is North Africa, near somewhere in Egypt, and essentially, you know, you've got all these soldiers of Christ, the Crusades with a big, you know, red cross on them, you know, big, you know, and these guys all serving Christ with massive swords, and then he turns up with a few brothers from the Brothers Minor, you know, the Order of the Brothers Minor, you know, in like, you know, tattered habits, and they were fighting through, and they suffered terrible losses, and yet he was the one that was able to go and see the Sultan, and he actually stood before the Sultan, who was Saladin's grandson. Okay, mm-hmm. and he was quite, and he was also very, you know, very very. Bold, actually, he said, look, I said, I, you know what? He said, I believe the God I serve is the God, you know, the God of all creation. In fact, I lay down a challenge. Let's do, like, you know, like Daniel, he wanted to lay down a challenge. So get your prophets out and we'll do a challenge between your God and mine. And this Sultan, who was as powerful as you can imagine, he always found him quite funny, and he didn't kill Francis. In fact, they managed to, you know, that was the sort of beginning of a peace accord. And there's a famous story about they believe linked with that, how after he flooded the Nile Delta and the Crusaders got bogged down, and they could have all got absolutely slaughtered and shot to death, but the Sultan was like, well, lay down your arms and I'll give you safe passage. And sometimes, you know, even if people lay down, they'll still get killed. Yeah. You know, it was but he did actually let them leave, and there was a peace accord. And the only people allowed to stay in that region, and the only order, Christian order and Catholic presence, was the Franciscans, was the, you know, the Brothers Minor. They were the only ones. So there was a sense in which the power and the fight and the soldiery, he'd somehow managed to, well, he'd taken his wounds from as a child and as a young man, and managed to, you know, and they say he did, you know, he prayed deeply, and he, you know, he had stigmata appeared in his late years. So he was very much, he understood on a physical, on a visceral level, the idea of wounding and the transformation of wounding into something beautiful.
Yes. And if you go back a few episodes, you'll catch up with me talking to two Franciscans for an hour.
Really?
Yeah, from Derry. They were brilliant. One was from Manchester as well, Brother Dominic, and the other one was Father Isaac from New York.
Oh, fantastic.
And both are Man City fans. Why were they Man City fans? Well, you just have to go back and listen to the episode. Tony, it's been brilliant talking to you, and more importantly, listening to you. Thanks you so much, sir. And I look forward to my freebie.